From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The time has come for a phasing out of sanctions against Cuba and Iran. That, according to a leading UN human rights investigator. Speaking Wednesday, ahead of his first report to the UN Human Rights Council, to be delivered in September, Idris Jazayeri, the UN's first independent expert on human rights and sanctions, told journalist Daniel Johnson that the first task before him was to gather enough information to determine exactly how many sanctions are currently in effect.
The hope of this mandate is that now that the process of diplomacy and negotiation has been started, there would be a phasing out of sanctions, which is a recognition of the failure of diplomacy.
So there isn't a sense that, as some people are saying, these sanctions are what brought Iran, for example, to the negotiating table. You'd refute that.
In the case of Iran, sanctions alone would not have solved the problem. But one must recognize that there's been a convergence between the imposition of stiffer sanctions on the one hand and a spectacular drop in the price of oil on the other. The combined effects of these two factors, the pincer effect, I would say, has had a very damaging effect on the economy of Iran, and in particular on the most vulnerable population groups in Iran, including women, children, people suffering from cancer, etc.
That's the point, isn't it? There are targeted sanctions, but in fact, it's really the people on the ground, in your opinion, who are suffering. Do you get to visit these countries, the countries that you're interested in as part of your new mandate? And I should say you are the first special rapporteur on international sanctions.
Yes, I have already received an invitation to visit Sudan, which has been one of the targeted countries by international sanctions. My concern is not to discuss the politics of sanctions, but rather to address the adverse impact of what we call unilateral coercive measures on the most vulnerable groups, as I said there. And in the case of Iraq, it was clear that whatever benefit could be pursued, say, by trying to reduce the dangerosity, as it were, of the policy of the Iraqi government, these lost legitimacy in light of the sufferings which were imposed on the population.
With the presentation of your first report at the next Human Rights Council session in September, without wishing to give any spoilers, can you give us an insight into your recommendations?
Yes. First, I will be pointing out the necessity to get a clearer picture of what these sanctions are. I know that there are about 32 targeted sanctions by the US, and I know there are about 37 by the EU. I know that the Security Council itself applies about 16 targets of sanction. We must remember also that there are many other cases of sanctions by individual countries which are not as transparent. I have written to member states applying sanctions and have asked them to send me the list of their sanctions. Unfortunately, I have not gotten a response. Are there 50 countries? Are there 10 corporate groups? Are there hundreds of individuals? We don't have a full picture. And I am appealing to members that apply sanctions. And I'm not criticizing their right to do so, just to be transparent about it and to give us all the elements so that we can best together, in a spirit of consensus, address these issues and see if we can at least minimize the impact of these sanctions on human rights for the vulnerable segments of the population.
As we've previously reported, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, the son of the late Muammar Gaddafi, was sentenced to death in absentia by the militia based in Tripoli, known as the Libyan Dawn. During the trial in the former capital of Libya, he remained in Zintan, where he's been held for the past 4 years by that city's militia, which captured him in 2011. The second son of the late Libyan leader and his second wife, Zafia Farkash, Saif holds a PhD from London School of Economics and was a part of his father's inner circle, performing public relations and diplomatic services on behalf of the country. He publicly turned down the offer of the country's second highest post and held no official government position, according to American State Department officials in Tripoli. Until the 2011 war, he was the second most widely recognized person in Libya and was considered by many to be the de facto prime minister, although Saif publicly rejected this title. An arrest warrant was issued for him by the International Criminal Court for charges of crimes against humanity against the Libyan people for allegations of torture and the killing of civilians, charges that he has denied. Saif Gaddafi was captured on November 19, 2011, after the end of the U.S.-led war on Libya in the southern part of the country and taken by plane to Zintan, which is still under the control of a local militia. He was sentenced to death this past Tuesday by that militia for his alleged crimes in the 2011 war. The group that the West recognizes as the Libyan government has condemned his jailing, conviction, and sentencing. Political analyst Dan Glazebrook was asked by RT's Eunan O'Neill Wednesday what the chances were that the militia holding him in Zintan would turn him over to the militia in Tripoli that sentenced him.
I don't think he'll be handed over because, remember, he's being held by the Zintan militia. Mm. Libya's in a state of civil war. The Zintan militia have sided with the House of Representatives. That's the parliament that was elected last year. Whereas the trial was held, as your last speaker just said, under duress in Tripoli, which has been held by a kind of ragtag alliance called the Libya Dawn, of the various kind of sectarian militias and so on that took hold of the capital last summer. So why one side in the civil war would hand over one of their only kind of strategic bargaining chips in a way to the other side is very unlikely to happen, isn't it? So no, I don't think he'll be carried out. So it's quite symbolic. But as your previous report mentioned, the others who've been handed down death sentences are being held in Tripoli and are likely to be executed by a firing squad. And it's a travesty of justice, really. I think what it is an attempt by the Libya Dawn faction within the civil war who control Tripoli. It's an attempt by them to scapegoat these members of the former government for all the chaos and the problems Libya is currently in. Because if you look at the state of Libya today, thousands of people of black-skinned Libyans and African migrants remain held in illegal detention centers, facing regular torture and ill treatment. Basic services are still a distant memory for the vast majority of Libyans. And the country is still racked by this traumatizing, devastating civil war. So these sentences are an attempt to try and mobilize and direct people's anger away from those who actually aided and collaborated with NATO in imposing this mess on Libya and towards, actually, ironically, members of the very government that actually oversaw a unified, peaceful and prosperous country. So it's really an attempt to scapegoat the people like Saif al-Islam for the chaos that those very militias have plunged the country into in alliance with NATO back in 2011.
Yeah, given the issues that you've just mentioned and Libya's powerless state over the past 4 years, what chances were there of Saif Gaddafi actually having a fair trial?
Well, no chance, because there's no real functioning institutions in Libya anymore. And this was the whole purpose of the NATO intervention, was to destroy the entire Libyan state apparatus, which unfortunately it did very successfully. So as we've seen, the whole country is in the hands of one or other of one of many hundreds of rival militias. So, you know, the chance of having a kind of stable, unified, democratic legal system in those circumstances is nil. And this was the whole purpose of the NATO operation, was to render that country and its state dysfunctional, which unfortunately it succeeded. And this is one of the results. You don't get a functioning legal system when you don't have a functioning state.
Dan, let's just remind everybody of an astonishing comment from former US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton after Muammar Gaddafi's death in 2011. Just stand by for a moment, please.
Okay. Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
So we came, we saw, he died. Isn't that a pretty cynical way to describe the coup? What does it tell you about America's approach to those events as Libyan security collapsed then?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's a big joke to them, isn't it? You hear Hillary Clinton laughing. And of course, it's not just about the death of one man. What that actually symbolized, like I say, is the plunging of that country into probably a generation or more of permanent warfare. And she finds that a big joke, a highly amusing little joke of hers. So this really tells you the kind of cynicism, and you know, people around the whole world should be very aware that this is how they, this is the kind of contempt that they're actually treated with when people like Clinton or Obama come offering, you know, democracy and peace and so on and so forth.
Do you think the West realized the consequences of its intervention in 2011?
Absolutely. It hasn't been on Mars for the last 10, 15 years. It's been conducting very similar operations with the exact same results. It's turned one state after another into failed states, Afghanistan, Iraq, even Kosovo, very rarely mentioned in the news. Kosovo is basically a gangster state, and the group that was supported in Kosovo by the West, the KLA, are some of the main drug runners and importers of forced sexual slaves into Europe. Kosovo has been turned over to them. So all of these interventions, they've had all of these experiences of conducting these interventions, regime change and so on, and they've also had exactly the same results, which is creation of one failed state after another. So they know very well the impact. They knew by 2011 exactly what happened to Libya. They would turn it into another Afghanistan, another Iraq. They knew that perfectly well, and that was the intention.
Just a related aspect here. Just a few years ago, Saif Gaddafi was being lauded in VIP circles in the West, now faces a firing squad. We know that he sat down with the royal family at Buckingham Palace. He hung out with a lot of rich people in the West. We've heard that quite a few times today since this news. Do you expect his former friends to do anything? And if not, why not?
They were never friends. This is the first point. They were never friends. And he himself, in the interview you've been playing recently, recognized that very clearly, that actually what was happening is he was being lulled into a kind of false sense of security, lulled into thinking, don't worry, we'll protect you, we'll do business with you, and so on. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, of course, they'd never forgiven his father for taking over the British and American air bases in Libya in 69, or for you know, actually being the mastermind behind the oil boycott in the 70s in opposition to the Israeli war in 1973. Gaddafi's never been forgiven for any of this, or for funding the African liberation movements or the Sandinistas and so on, or the Irish national movement. He's never been forgiven for that. And the seeming period of rapprochement and so on, where they seem to be fading and so on, Saif al-Islam in London, was nothing but a means of lulling him into giving them access into the country, freeing the former al-Qaeda prisoners that were then the spearhead of the NATO operation on the ground. All of this was just a means of lulling him into doing these things. And he himself recognized that pretty soon after events unfolded in 2011, that actually he'd been fooled, unfortunately. So they're not going to come to his aid, because they were never genuinely his friends in the first place.
Back in July of 2011, as the war against his country raged, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi spoke with RT's Maria Finoshina about that U.S.-led war and the then-pending ICC cases against both himself and his father.
Well, in 2008, you were welcomed in London. Tony Blair embraced your father. You received your PhD from London School of Economics. And now, just 3 years on, you're a media villain, targeted by NATO missiles in your own country, split by civil war. Why do you think has your fate turned so violently?
It's a good lesson for everybody, for us and for others. We heard, we got messages from many countries, and we heard many news from Iran, North Korea, saying, this is your mistake, Libyans. You give up your weapons of mass destruction, you stopped developing long-range missiles, you became very friendly with the West, and this is the result. So, what does it mean? It means this is a message to everybody, that you have to be strong, you never trust them, and you have to be always on alert, because those people, they don't have friends. Over one night, they change their mind and they start bombing us. And the same thing could happen to any other country.
Talking about mistakes and lessons, what would you have done differently?
One of our big mistakes, mm-hmm. that we stopped, not we stopped, we delayed buying new weapons, especially from Russia. It was a big mistake, by the way. We delayed that. and we delayed building a strong army because we thought that we will not fight again. The Americans, the Europeans are our friends. We will not fight again. So not to build a strong and modern army was a big, big mistake, because we thought that we solved our problems and now we are a peaceful country. And no WMD anymore, no Lockerbie, normal relation, we do business. The Libyans said this, it was our mistake to be very tolerant with our enemies. So now everybody is blaming me that it's because of you, because you were tolerant, you were nice with everybody, and now you brought all the enemies from abroad to Libya, and this is the result.
You are charged by the International Criminal Court with designing, quotation, a state policy aimed at deterring and quelling by any means, including by the use of lethal force, the demonstrations of civilians against Gaddafi's regime, which started in February 2011. Does such a policy exist?
Come on, they accuse me of killing people. Everybody knows, even the rebels themselves. They are not accusing me of using force or killing, because I'm not in the army, I'm not in the government. So for me to be responsible for killing people, it was a big joke. Second joke, that the people who died at the beginning, 159. Most of the people died when they attacked military sites. And this would happen anywhere anywhere in the world. In Russia, in America, in France, in Germany, in Italy. If people in the street move towards a military site trying to steal ammunition or arms, the military will prevent them. And this is what happened in Benghazi.
Who were these people?
Later on, we found out that most of them, they belong to an Islamic groups. But it was too late at that time.
Direct question. Did you or your father order the army to kill protesters?
Of course not. This, number one, no. Second, my father called the General Abu Fattah. He's in Benghazi now. Mm-hmm. He's one of the leaders of the rebels. He called him, and I called him. And the calls are recorded. We told him many times, don't use the force with people. He told us, but they are attacking the military sites. It's a very difficult situation.
Who did order
Nobody
to kill
ordered.
Them?
Nobody. The guards fired. That's it. They fired at the demonstration. The guards were surprised by the attack of the people, and they start firing. They don't need the order to defend themselves and to defend their barracks and their camps.
What's the purpose of this warrant when NATO is already trying to kill your father?
This court is a Mickey Mouse court. The sentence or against us is already. The capital punishment. So they decided to kill me and to kill my father. And they did kill my brother. And they destroyed my house. So the decision is made to execute you. So now you are talking about arrest me. I mean, you 3 months ago you decided to kill me. And you are after me every day. You are trying to find me and to kill me every day and my father. So this is number one. Number two, just to tell you that it's a fake court. Under the table, they are trying to negotiate with us a deal. They said, if you accept this deal, we will take care of the court. What does it mean? It means the court is controlled by those countries which are attacking us every day. It's just to put a psychological and political pressure on us. That's it.
You say NATO is trying to kill you, right?
Today I was swimming and fishing because it was very hot and we went to the beach.
Oh, really?
So we are in our country, enjoying our life, fighting for our country, living with our people. If we live, we live in our country with our people. If we die, we go to heaven. So what?
NATO is bombing Libya, and the Libyan government says that more than 900 people have been killed since the beginning of the operation in March, while NATO has only admitted 9 civilian deaths.
NATO destroyed our house in the middle of a residential area. Mm-hmm. Small house. Surrounded by many houses, people are living there. There is a small school next to them. They bombed that house with 4 missiles. They killed my brother. He young, civilian. He had nothing to do with the war, with politics. He was studying in Germany. because of the war, he came back to Libya. He was there, sleeping, they killed him. What NATO said, we bombed a command and control center. What command control center? So it was two bedrooms, kitchen, living room, small house. Just to give you an example from my family, let alone many other examples. 1 week ago, they hit the house of a friend of my father. Killed the whole family. The wife, pregnant, died. Two young girls, all of them died. And he said, again, we are hitting a military site. A pregnant wife with her kids. They are controlling and commanding Libyan troops. Come on. It's very silly. It's very funny. Shame on them. They have one target. This country is a piece of cake. Rich, full of gas, oil, and we have more than $100 billion deposits abroad. So we have to share this cake. That's it. And we have to get off Mr. Gaddafi because he's the only obstacle between us and the cake. It's as simple as that.
But there are some people saying that if Gaddafi goes, the fighting will stop.
Stop? Of course not. Because their goal is not Gaddafi. Their goal is to control Libya. Is to control Libya. This is the target. And the Libyans will not allow them to do that. So the fight will continue.
What do you think about media war? Who's winning this war?
At the beginning, they won. Yeah, they won. Especially Al Jazeera, they won. Because it was planned from the beginning. It said, Gaddafi is in Venezuela. The regime collapsed. The rebels occupied Tripoli. And the regime gone. And to a big chaos in the whole country. We are still now suffering from that chaos. But now the Libyans are aware. One day, everybody in the world is saying the Libyan Navy is bombing the harbor of Mizda. Mizda is in the middle of the desert. It's 1,000 kilometers from here. The Libyan ships are bombing the harbor of Mizda. Excuse me, what's this? The Security Council issued their resolution against Libya because of a fake media report saying that the Libyan Air Force is bombing civilian districts in Tripoli and killing 7,000 people.
We've started with the past. Let me finish with the future. It's known that you got a message from the front that there will be no place for you in a post-war Libya. And with this ICC warrant arrest, you are a wanted man abroad. So realistically, where do you go from here?
Who?
You.
Well, many people are angry with me, and they are right, because they said that the head of rebels, they were my friends, but at that time I was very liberal, tolerant, and very peaceful. I'm still peaceful to a certain extent, and I thought that Libyans are equals, so everybody has the right to. To be in Libya, to work here, to be active, to do whatever they want. But later on we found, not me, that the whole nation found that they were, it was a big conspiracy managed by those people against Libya. So they said it's because of you, those snakes managed to penetrate our country and work with foreigners to destroy our country. So we are very angry with you because you are very tolerant. And don't forget, I released all the prisoners. At the beginning of the event, there were zero prisoners. So everybody's blaming because of you. It's too much tolerance.
But do you think they are right?
To be honest, we were super tolerant. Mm-hmm. I was naive. Yes.
You're no longer naive?
Not anymore.
How you changed?
I will not repeat the mistake. I will not be hit again from the same snake, from the same hole. So, I can kiss you, I can forgive you, but I will not forget. So what you have done is going to be in our mind for a long time. And every move, every step will be calculated according to that experience.
When all this nightmare will be over, how do you think?
Listen, NATO and rebels, both are in a hurry. They want to finish as soon as possible because they are hungry, they are tired, they want to share the cake. Mm-hmm. It's like, for them, Libya is like fast food, like McDonald's, fast. Because everything should be fast. Fast war, fast airplanes, fast bullets, fast victory. But we are very patient because we are in our country. It's our country. We live here, we die here. So we are very patient. One day, the French will go back to Corsica and France, the Italians will go back to Sicily and Italy, the Danish will go back to Denmark, the Canadians will go back to Toronto, and Libya will be back to the Libyans.
Cynthia McKinney is a former member of the U.S. House of Representatives and the 2008 Green Party presidential candidate. She was in Libya numerous times before, during, and after the U.S.-led war against that country. We spoke with her via Skype Wednesday.
Well, what I can say is that before the U.S.-led intervention, well, actually, I shouldn't say intervention, but the U.S.-led destruction of the country, you know, there were several things that we noticed. One of the things that we noticed was that there weren't any homeless people. You know, like, you can go downtown of any city in the United States and you'll find homeless people. And if you're walking around, you might even have to step over them. They're so plentiful in the United States. Well, we didn't see homeless people. We also didn't see beggars. So there wasn't, you know, the kind of poverty or income inequality. What we did notice was that there were African students. Of course, Libya is in Africa, but there were non-Libyan African students who were there, and they were given laptops. They were there studying. They were given full ride scholarships. And so you could say that Libya was an engine of growth, of for growth for the entire continent. And the ideology of the Libyans, which is what was really the target, was to destroy the ideology of the Jamahiriya. The ideology of the Libyans was that their responsibility was to be that engine of growth for the entire continent.
Yeah, and the just for those who don't know, the Jamahiriya means the state of the masses, self-government.
That's right. And in fact, the when I was there the first time, the major issue was how they were going to spend their oil revenues. Were they going to continue the gasoline subsidy, or were they going to spend more money on education? And the interesting thing is that everyone had a say in this decision. So that was what people were talking about, and they were planning their strategy on how to prevail for their particular point of view. And this whole notion was of people governing themselves was stamped out with the bunker buster bombs that President Obama ordered to be dropped over Libya. Of course, those bombs also carried depleted uranium. And so the entire country has been destroyed, including the Great Man-Made River.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.